Part 3 of King David's story involves belonging. The Bible has much to say regarding the necessity of friendships and defines the four different kinds of friends. What are the keys to being a good friend, and in what ways can we make the story of David's journey apply to our lives in Christ? Here's Pastor Seth.
We've been doing a series on the last half of the life of David. When I think of this David's story from the last half forward, I think about the five B's, which is a shorthand for our church. And that's, you see this in David's story. How did God deal with David when his life cratered? How does he deal with us? What are the different components that God deals with us through our life? And then I think about, in a sense, that this is true for us. It's also, in a sense, true for us as a church collectively. The first B is broken. The Bible tells that there's something inside of us, in our heart, that's broken. We aren't the people we really wish we could be. We fall short. We miss the mark. We're wrapped in on ourselves too much. We're too easily hurt by other people. There's just a whole litany of things that make for all kinds of drama and messes. And what complicates this is that it's so hard not only for us to see these things, but even if we do, to own them. But when we do, it leads us to the second B, and that is the beloved. That when we realize that I am a mess and I am self-centered through and through, and that drives who I am so much of the time without me even knowing it, that I am God's beloved. He loves me anyway. His love trumps my sinfulness, my self-centeredness, which we saw last week in David. And today we're looking at belonging. Belonging means that as a church or as God's people, that we really do need each other. Being a Christian is not a solo event. That is the really slow and painful way to do the Christian life. We really do need other people, as we're going to see in David's story today about belonging. One of my favorite events from professional baseball, Major League Baseball, happened a number of years ago, before I was alive, but it's become legendary in the baseball world. Jackie Robinson became the starting shortstop for the Brooklyn Dodgers, and he was the first black man to play in Major League Baseball. That was pretty shattering for many people in our country at the time, not really sure what to do with that. And he went through a lot of grief and persecution that first year in the major leagues. Some of the pitchers that he lined up against would throw at his head when he was at bat. Some of the guys that were trying to steal second base would come up with their spiked cleats up high if he was trying to cover the bag. Some of the guys in the other dugout would make these posters with some words that I can't repeat in a public setting. And then everywhere he went, whether it was in a stadium or on the bus, you know, at a bus stop where they were going, he just took all kinds of grief. It was horrific. Well, it seemed to reach sort of a fever pitch one day at Fenway Park in Boston. It was an away game, and he made an error at shortstop, and all of a sudden there was just sort of this cacophony of sound and boos and catcalls against him, and the play, of course, stopped, and everybody just sort of sat there for a minute. And Pee Wee Reese, who was the second baseman, a white guy, at second base, sort of realized the poignancy of the moment. And he walked over to Jackie Robinson, and he put his arm around him. And there in the middle of the field, or near second base, he was there as if, "This is my friend." Now, years later, when Jackie Robinson would tell his story, he would say that that moment saved his career. That year, he could not, he knew that if he retaliated, if he spoke out, if he did anything like that, that the plight of the black athlete would probably never make Major League Baseball, or would be set back even more. Saved his life, or saved his career. When I think about that story, it has nothing to do with baseball. It has to do with the strength of a friend who is with somebody else in the moment of their either perceived failure or shame. He saved Jackie Robinson's career. Sometimes I wonder if an arm doesn't save somebody's life, or if it doesn't save somebody's marriage, or other types of things. David's life, as we've seen, cratered at the pinnacle of his kingship. He committed adultery with Bathsheba. That became public knowledge. And his young sons, adult sons, all just became out of control. One of the sons raped a half-sister. David was the father of both, but by a different mother. And the brother of Tamar, the woman, young woman who was raped, Absalom determined that he was going to do Amnon in, and 2 years later, he murdered him. If that was not hard enough in the midst of all of this grief to go through as a parent, Absalom also worked for 4 years to slowly steal the kingdom right out from David. He was at the city gates most days, and the scriptures record that he did two things every day he was there. First thing he did was he flattered the people who came into the city every time. And the second thing he did was he asked them why they were coming, and every time somebody said that there was a problem that they had, there was some kind of injustice, think about dealing with the DMV or some government agency, the frustration you have, Absalom would claim that, well, if I was king, it would be different around here. We would have real justice. And after 4 years, he had enough of sort of a groundswell of loyalty that he went to a neighboring town, Hebron, and pronounced himself king. There was enough people that followed him, and he was on his way back to Jerusalem that David realized that he had to flee for his life, he and his family and entourage. Now, maybe your life hasn't experienced the kind of cratering that David's went through. But whenever life gets really, really tough like that, the easiest thing to do is withdraw. Now, my life has not cratered to the extent of David. But every week, I can feel that same temptation to just want to withdraw to some kind of safety or just away from problems that sometimes just seem all around me. And there are different reasons why it seems like I want to do that. Sometimes I just get so tired of feeling sad. Sometimes I don't want to think about the stories of people that I'm familiar with. In my own life, when I'm going through some really sad, tough stories with people I care about, I just don't want to think about those stories, or I don't want to tell those stories to somebody else. I just get so tired of feeling sad sometimes. Sometimes we withdraw because we're afraid that somebody's, when they hear our story, is going to give us unwanted advice. Or they're going to give some kind of cliche answer that tells us they really don't understand what we're going through. There's a terrible price for that withdrawing. And the terrible price that we pay is loneliness. Loneliness. When our life craters and we withdraw, the easiest thing, and sometimes the sharpest pain, is the loneliness that we feel. Now, thankfully, God uses loneliness redemptively in our lives. If you sense that loneliness, and yeah, I wish I could do something about that, I'm right there, Seth. Go to YouTube, and I did a message on this, how God uses loneliness redemptively in our lives, October 5th of 2014. So that might be the best thing you get from today's message. You can go and where I deal with this particularly. How does God redemptively use loneliness in our life? Now, even with the best of friends and the best of people, the best of family situations that you could have, none of us are immune from loneliness. At least not until we're in heaven. Loneliness is a part of this life. But thankfully, God does use that redemptively to pull us to himself, that we long for something more than what the best marriage or the best kids or the best career or best friends can give us. There's a deeper hunger inside of us that really requires something from God. Even somebody like the Apostle Paul went through loneliness. Near the end of his life, he was arrested in Rome. He was going to have to go before the emperor for a trial. And as he was waiting for the trial in prison, this is what he records at the end of 2 Timothy 4, verse 16. "At my first defense, no one came to my support, but everyone deserted me." Now, that's an amazing statement. because it's at the end of his life, and he usually had a missionary team with him of young men that he was training to do missions. And even with a highly committed group of men at this particular venture in his life, the thing was so scary, so life-threatening, that they all went for the shadows. Then he says an amazing thing: may it not be held against them. You see something of the maturity that God had put in this man. Then he says, and here's one of the redemptive parts of loneliness: but the Lord stood at my side and gave me strength, just like we sang about a few minutes ago, so that through me the message might be fully proclaimed and all the Gentiles might hear it. Meaning that even in the midst of feeling lonely and abandoned, and the self-pity monster wanting to come up over me, God is here and he's going to strengthen me, not just to endure loneliness, but to still be on mission, that I have a purpose here, even in this prison, to share the gospel with the people around him. And then he says, I was delivered from the lion's mouth. It's a great image. There are four different kinds of friends that we're going to look at when David's life cratered. And all four of these different friends sort of are like four quarters of a pizza, that when you put all four of these different things together, it's like not any one of them really did the trick. But you put all four of these kinds of friends together, you got a pretty good pizza, large pizza. Four kinds of friends. The first one, loyalty and flexibility in the face of failure. The first kind of friend is somebody who's loyal and flexible, meaning they don't have an idea of what they'll do to help, or when it's convenient, or what they like doing to help, or what makes sense to them. They are trying to think of, what does my friend need? And then I'm going to do whatever it is that my friend thinks makes sense to them to meet their needs. We pick up the story in 2 Samuel 15. A messenger came and told David, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. This is when he hears that the throne has just been usurped, and he's just a few miles away. Then David said to all his officials who were with him in Jerusalem, come, we must flee, or none of us will escape from Absalom. We must leave immediately, or he will move quickly to overtake us and bring ruin upon us and put the city to the sword. David knew that his own son was a ruthless man. And if he was going to take over the king, he would make sure that nobody was left around, even his own father, to take the king. Now, all of us who have been parents, at least as old as older teenage years mostly, have some experience with parental pain. My mom told me when I was being an idiot when I was a teenager, she said, son, you'll never know how much a parent loves you and how much a parent cares. It's just impossible for a child to know that. And she was right. And there's pains that you experience as a parent that are not going to make sense to your kids probably until they have kids their age. I can't imagine David going through this with the meltdown of his sons, the rape of Tamar, the murder and the usurpation of his throne, and now having to flee for his life. Now, he tells all these guys that are with him, I'm on the most wanted list. And if my son gets a hold of me, he's going to take the sword to me. I'm going to flee. And he sort of gives them the option. You can go with me, or you can stay here. It's up to you. And these men exhibit what strikes me as loyalty and flexibility with David. Look at their response. The king's officials answered him, your servants are ready to do whatever our lord, the king, chooses. They could have said, David, you better flee for your life, but we're keeping our families here. We're staying here. We're going to go to Absalom and tell him, hey, we served the king before. We're going to serve you as king. Could have done that. No, they were loyal to him and flexible. I wonder what the effect on David was when they said that. We're with you, not just through thick and thin, but through thick and thick. Wherever you go, we're going to be there. Proverbs says, a man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer to a brother. That's what he's describing here with these men. Verse 16, the king set out with his entire household following him. So the king set out with all the people following him, and they halted at a place some distance away. All his men marched past him along with, and he mentions three groups or battalions, we would think of them, as part of his army that were going with him. The Kerethites, the Pelethites, and all the 600 Gittites who had accompanied him from Gath marched before the king. Now, these men were also taking their life in their own hands. This would have been considered treasonous by the new king Absalom. Verse 19, the king says to Ittai, the third friend that's mentioned here, Ittai the Gittite, truly an unfortunate name. He says to him, Ittai, why should you come along with us? Go back and stay with King Absalom. You are a foreigner, an exile from your homeland. You came only yesterday. Now catch this. Ittai the Gittite had heard about King David. He was well known in that part of the world as a mighty warrior and a man of character. Ittai brings 600 folks with him. They arrive the day before the throne is overtaken. And Ittai has a choice to make. Now he's the new kid on the block. He didn't have to say anything. He could have just stayed with Absalom, joined the army. Here we are. It's our new home. But on the basis of David's reputation and character, Ittai says to him, David says, go back and stay with the king Absalom. You're a foreigner, an exile from your homeland. You came only yesterday. Today shall I make you wander about with us? When I do not know where I'm going, we're fleeing. Go back. Take your countrymen. May kindness and faithfulness be with you. David is also a friend, in back to him. He's given him his get-out-of-jail-free card, or get-out-of-danger-free card. You don't have to put yourself in such a perilous situation as this. Now, that's quite a statement for David to make. Because whenever your back is against the wall and your life is cratering, if there's just one person who's willing to stand with you, you're ready to sort of gobble them up and you know, you're hard-pressed to let them go. But David had open hands with his friends. He wasn't just concerned about what kind of friend are you going to be to me. His sort of DNA was, what kind of friend am I going to be to you? And he gives him that free pass to go. But look at Ittai's response, verse 21. Ittai replied to the king, as surely as the Lord lives and as my Lord the king lives, wherever, David didn't know where he was going, wherever my lord the king may be, whether it means life or death, there will your servant be. There's a loyalty and a flexibility that in the midst of your life cratering, I'm going to hang in there wherever you go, no matter what it costs me. Those friends are really rare. But when your life is cratering, they are really important. The second picture we get of friendship is somebody that's profoundly for you. They are profoundly for you. The whole countryside wept aloud as all the people passed by. So David is there at the gate. His entourage, family, some of the remnants of the army are leaving. They go through the Kidron Valley, up the hill, the other side, out towards the desert. And as the people are going out there, the people who live on the outskirts of Jerusalem in the countryside are all weeping as they realize what's going on. Then the king also crossed the Kidron Valley, and all the people moved on toward the desert. And then we meet two of the second kind of folks. Zadok was there too. He was a priest. And all the Levites who were him were with him carrying the Ark of the Covenant of God. Levites were people that worked in the sanctuary there, and they would take the Ark of the Covenant with them. They were going out with David. And Abiathar, another priest, offered sacrifices until all the people had finished leaving the city. Now, these two priests had pretty good job. They didn't have to leave Jerusalem. This is not a political question with them. They could have stayed in the sanctuary and could have done their priestly jobs tomorrow like they'd done them yesterday. But they had a choice to make. What are they going to do? And they decide to throw their lot in with David And they instruct the Levites to take the Ark of the Covenant out of Jerusalem, a very public demonstration of loyalty. And Abiathar is out there in the middle of the countryside offering sacrifices until all the people come by. If Absalom had seen this, and certainly if he heard about this, he would have considered that treasonous as well, leading the people away from his kingship. What was David's response to this? The king said to Zadok, take the Ark of God back into the city. Yeah, the idea is you've done well, and I appreciate your loyalty here, but it doesn't belong here. If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he will bring me back and let me see it and his dwelling place again. David doesn't know what the future holds. He's not really even sure of how God looks at him because of just the complete disaster that has unfolded over the last several years. He says, if I find favor in the Lord's eyes, you know, kind of don't know what's going to happen, how this is going to play out. I may die out here in the desert. God may bring me back. Don't know. If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he will bring me back and let me see it and his dwelling again. Verse 26, but if he says, if God says, I'm not pleased with you, then I am ready. Let him do to me whatever seems good to him. Now, this anchors David. He understands something of our second B, beloved. That there is something deeper than being broken and all the drama that he's created that anchors him to the character of God, and he throws himself what we call surrender, surrenders his life, his future to God to say, whatever it is you think best, that's where I'm going to go. Verse 27, the king also said to Zadok the priest, aren't you a seer? Go back to the city in peace, and your son Ahimaaz and Jonathan, son of Abiathar, you and Abiathar take your two sons with you. So he gives them the same card that he gave Ittai. You don't have to be in this dangerous situation. This is your get out of danger free card. Go back to Jerusalem. And with both of these men, Zadok and Abiathar and David, these are rare birds. Two guys are willing to put themselves in extreme danger for David, and David is willing to let them go. He appreciates what they've done, but he really doesn't want them to be in the kind of danger he's going to be in. They're rare birds. Paul had somebody like this called Timothy. And in Philippians 2, 20 and 21, as he's describing Timothy to the people in the church at Philippi, he says, I have no one else like him. There's no other guy like this. One. I have no one else like him who takes a genuine interest in you. That's quite a statement. I have no one else like him who takes a genuine interest in you. For everyone looks out for his own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. That's quite a statement. This is what's described in these two men who are profoundly for David, even at a cost. So David responds, I will wait at the fords in the desert until word comes from you to inform me. So he sends the guys back. He said, go back to Jerusalem. Go back to your duties. So Zadok and Abiathar take the Ark of God back to Jerusalem and stayed there. And David continued up the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went. It's the force of life, his sons, his daughter Tamar, the loss of his throne, the chaos that was being, that all started back with him and that fateful decision we looked at a couple of weeks ago. He continued up the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went. His head was covered, which was a sign of grief, and he was barefoot, a king barefoot. Another sign of grief. All the people with him covered their heads too. They were weeping as they went. Now, the Holy Spirit here sort of introduces us into the next type of the third kind of friend. And I think of this as a grief grabber. A grief grabber. These people are also remarkably rare. Paul says, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Over the years of both being a pastor and being a man, being a husband, being a father, and being a Christian, I have said some incredibly stupid and naive things to people who are in the midst of grief. It's been very easy at different times for me to minimize somebody's grief or to give some unwanted advice or something that's way too simplistic or to speak too quickly and not to really enter into the person's story and allow them to sort of tell their story and unpack it and to be curious to know more and more what's deeper and deeper in their story that they wish somebody would want to know and hear. And even at age 63, it seems like I am still learning how to do this. There are often times when I'm in a conversation with somebody who's in grief that I say something and I think I just spoke too quickly. Needed to ask more questions. Needed to listen more. A grief grabber. Somebody that understands when they're in grief that you understand what it's like to be in their moccasins. It's almost like they sense from you that they bear this burden of grief on their shoulders, but you want to come along next to them and you're just going to kind of reach up and sort of help them walk with this, if not take some of that and put it on your shoulders. These are really, really rare individuals, but this is what happens with one particular man that knows David. Verse 32. Remember that the context of this is David and all the people walking up weeping. When David arrived at the summit where people used to worship God, Hushai the Archite, another unfortunate name, Hushai the Archite was there to meet him. And notice what the Holy Spirit finds appropriate to share about Hushai. His robe torn and dust on his head. Now, what does that mean? In the Hebrew culture, whenever somebody was going through the worst of grief, they would take their outer garment up here and they would shred it like this, and it would tear down the front. And it was a picture to all the people they were around that you were in mourning, that you were grieving something horrific. Now, when he gets up there, Hushai already has a torn garment. And then the second thing that the Spirit of God tells us about was that he had dust on his head, meaning, well, it'd been a few days since he'd taken a shower or something. Now, this is also a picture of grief. Somebody in grief would sit down at the roadside in the dust, and they would take a handful of dust, and they would just let it go on their head. So you have this picture of Hushai the Archite sitting at the summit with a torn outer garment and dust on his head before David from his own mouth tells him what's gone on. Think about this. Hushai has figured out what's gone on, but he's already bearing David's grief before he even gets to the summit. And I wonder what happened when he walked up and saw Hushai with a torn outer garment and with dust on his head. If it had been me, I think I would have said, somebody gets me. They know what I'm going through. There's really no other way to describe the incredible parental grief and career loss and public shame that was going on with David. And here was somebody who is willing to say, I get it. Romans 12:15 says, rejoice with those who rejoice, mourn with those who mourn. Now, David talks to Hushai, and he says, I really have an assignment for you because you are a trustworthy man. Verse 34, if you return to the city and say to Absalom, again, a dangerous assignment, say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king. I was your father's servant in the past, but now I will be your servant. Then you can help me by frustrating Ahithophel's advice. Ahithophel had been one of David's counselors, sort of a right-hand man whose wisdom had served David for a long time. But now David has an idea. He's at war. War has been declared against him. He's in a fight for his life and for the nation. And David has an idea here of creating what we would call a spy ring, or a group of sort of double agents that are going to be working inside of the palace. Verse 35, won't the priests Zadok and Abiathar be there with you? Hushai, Zadok, Abiathar, spies within the palace. Tell them anything you hear in the king's palace. Their two sons, Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, and Jonathan, son of Abiathar, are there with them. Send them to me with anything you hear. So Hushai is going to be in the palace. He's going to be hearing Absalom's plans. Hushai is going to go to the sanctuary and tell Zadok and Abiathar what's going on. They're going to tell their sons. The sons are going to be the messenger boys to get the word out to David. It's a spy ring. Now, in the world of spies, all it takes is one discovery. Just one. And you lose your life. Just one. What was Hushai's response? Verse 37. Again, I love how the Holy Spirit phrases this. So David's friend, Hushai. David's friend, Hushai, arrived at Jerusalem as Absalom was entering the city. He's taken on the assignment. He's going to go back to the palace. He's going to volunteer to serve Absalom, just like he served his father, even at the risk of being considered a traitor and killed. The fourth kind of need is practical needs. Practical needs. Sometimes we need friends who are loyal and flexible just to come alongside us in a way that makes sense to us, not necessarily makes sense to them. Sometimes we need somebody that's profoundly for us. Sometimes we need a third kind of friend we just looked at of grief grabbers. And then sometimes it's just simple, practical needs make a difference. Proverbs 17:17 says, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. This is when we really need friends. Now, in chapter 17, a couple chapters forward, the story gets fast forwarded a little bit. They're out in the desert. When David and the entourage came to Mahanaim, and then we hear of three men. Shobi, son of Nahash, from Rabbah of the Ammonites. Number two, Maker, son of Ammiel, from Lodabar. And Barzillai, the Gileadite, from Rogelim. These three guys show up. Notice what they brought. They brought bedding. Think about the hundreds of people that were with David. They brought bedding and bowls and articles of clothing, or articles of pottery. They also brought wheat and barley, flour and roasted grain, beans and lentils. I could have done without the lentils, but made sense to them. Honey, curds, sheep, cheese from cow's milk for David and the people to eat. What strikes you about that list? I think about the word abundance. I think about the word variety. And I think about a whole lot of it for all these people and the timeliness of meeting their needs. And then notice what they said. The people have become hungry and tired and thirsty in the desert. Sometimes this kind of thoughtfulness carries the day, and sometimes the practical need themselves carries the day. This is a group of people who had been in the palace, and the palace treasury met all their needs every day. They had a great place to sleep. They never had to worry about food and drink. Now it's all gone. They're out in the desert, left to themselves. Three guys say something needs to be done about that. I think about Paul when I think about these four groups of men who became his friends. Paul knew what it was like to be a friend, and he knew what it was like that it was a costly endeavor to be a friend sometimes. So there are times when you try to be a good friend to somebody, and they just don't think you're that good a friend. That's painful. Not unusual. But in spite of all that, as he records in the second letter to Corinthians, where he had experienced some pain and misunderstanding and people that criticized him, he says in 2 Corinthians 12:15, a verse that for the last about 40 years I come back to again and again and again. This is both as a pastor, as a husband, as a parent, and as a friend. He says, I will most gladly spend and be spent for your souls. I will most gladly spend and be spent for your souls. I will most gladly spend and be spent for your souls. There was a boy walking home from school. He was a junior higher. His name was Johnny. And in front of him was another junior high boy named Billy. And Johnny watched Billy as he was walking home from school, and he tripped over the curb. And when he tripped, it looked like that Billy had been trying to carry every textbook that there was in school for every class. And he went up to help him. He also noticed that Billy was carrying two sweaters, a baseball bat, a baseball glove, and a tape recorder. A little junior high kid. So Johnny reached down, introduced himself. He started picking up the books, found out that they were going in the same direction. And so he picked up some of Billy's books and walked with him. When they got to Billy's house, Billy said, hey, you want to come in and have a Coke, watch TV? And he said, yeah. The two boys went in Billy's house, they had a Coke, they watched some TV. And Johnny found out that Billy enjoyed history, enjoyed video games, enjoyed baseball. But he's also not doing well in school, and his girlfriend had just broken up with him. And especially in junior high, that's like my life is over kind of thing. He stayed there for a couple hours, and they became friends. And over the next number of years, through high school, you know, they continued to keep their friendship going. Fast forward to 3 weeks before high school graduation. Billy comes up to Johnny and says, you know, Johnny, I don't know if you remember how we met. Johnny said, well, yeah, I do. He said, what you don't know is why I was carrying all of my books home. My baseball glove, my baseball bat, my tape recorder. As you remember, my girlfriend broke up with me. I wasn't doing well in school. I knew where my mother's sleeping pills were. And I was on my way home to kill myself. And I didn't want to leave anything behind in my locker. You came along and helped me pick up my books, my sweaters, baseball bat, baseball glove, tape recorder, went home, had Coke, watched TV. And after you left, I thought about going and taking those pills and committing suicide. But I realized that if I did that, I would miss having times like that with you again. And over these last 4 years, that's certainly been true. He said, you have no idea that when you picked up my books and walked with me, you saved my life. Looks like a little thing, doesn't it? But this is what belonging is. It's coming along next to the people as they are and walking with them, whatever is going on with them. Let's pray together. Father, it's very easy for us, when we think about friendship, to immediately go to the, how come I don't have friends like that? How come people don't treat me the way that that Seth described, these four different groups of friends? The thing we don't think about very often is, what kind of friend am I? And how can I be somebody that exhibits each of these different four kinds of friendships to the people around me? The most amazing thing to me about this story is that our God exhibits this kind of friendship to you and me. He is loyal to us, and he shows great flexibility. The Bible calls that long-suffering. His patience with us. The cross tells us he is profoundly for us, and nothing can change that. He knows what it's like to carry grief, which he did at the cross, including our grief. And he met the most practical need we have, that of forgiveness and a washing of our heart, the beginning to transform that which is broken within us and to make us like Jesus Christ. Father, would you take pieces of this story and speak to the hearts of your people? Help us to hear from you today. Help us to walk out of here with something important that you have said to us.